Welcome to Modern Minds, a podcast for the Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network. Welcome to Modern Minds. I'm your host, Mark Hennick. This is a limited series about the modern state of mental health care as we know it today, and hopefully as we're working to have it tomorrow. Over the next 10 episodes, I'm going to be speaking with a selection of guests on a range of important topics, all related to mental health and the revolution that's already underway all around us. On this very first episode of the show, we're going to be talking about co-design in mental health. There's an old saying in this type of work: nothing about us without us. That is, we can't do recovery to people. We have to build programs and treatments and service systems in which the people who are receiving care have a say in every level of the care that they're receiving. This is how we break down the silos that separate us, and this is how we help people to heal. To talk about this very important approach today, I'm joined by Emmy Nietfeld. Emmy is the author of the new book, Acceptance, a Memoir, and she recently wrote a widely shared op-ed for the New York Times that was titled, "I Edited My Mental Illness Out of My College Applications, I'm Not Alone." She and I discussed both the benefits and the potential costs for the person with lived expertise to self-disclose their diagnosis. But before we get to Emmy, though, you're going to hear from Dr. Ken Duckworth. Dr. Duckworth is the chief medical officer for NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. NAMI has a new book out, too, authored by Dr. Duckworth, and that's called You Are Not Alone, The NAMI Guide to Navigating Mental Health. Dr. Javed Sukera led that conversation for us, and I jump in a little bit at the end. So let's get going by first touching base with him. Dr. Sukera is the chair of psychiatry at the Institute of Living, and he's the chief of psychiatry at Hartford Hospital under the Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network. Dr. Javed Sukera, thanks so much for kicking off this brand new show, Modern Minds, with us. And I'm hoping that we can talk a little bit about what this show is going to be all about. So let's start this with a bit of my thinking on what the next 10 conversations or next 10 episodes filled with conversations are going to be. I'm hoping that we can focus on not only cutting-edge advancements in the science and the research of mental health, but in some ways more importantly, in many ways more importantly, on advancements on the practical side, on the human side of actual service delivery. You know, how can we do better and do differently with the resources that we have, with the knowledge that we already have? So I'm wondering what you're hoping to hear from the next 10 episodes, all the guests that we're going to have on Modern Minds.
Well, I think we need to have this conversation. And having a candid conversation that challenges long-held assumptions, that critically reflects on some of the norms that kind of govern what we do and how we do it, it's long overdue. We are not dealing with the same demand for services. We aren't having the same conversation that we were having even 2, 5, or 10 years ago. So I'm really looking forward to having a candid, at times difficult conversation, not just about where we're at in terms of what we do, the system, the services that exist, the approaches that we use to help people, but on what the future needs to look like and how we're going to get there working together.
Yeah, now, you know, in a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Dr. Ken Duckworth from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Mostly you, I jump in a little bit because I have my burning curiosity. In your view, you know, you've been a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist for a number of years now. You've kind of straddled both worlds of clinical practice, but also policy and research. You know, you've done a little bit of everything. What has been the evolution that you've seen in terms of how we approach mental health? Is there much movement or change in your field and in the field more broadly?
I think that there is a lot of movement and things are changing, but they're not changing enough. So absolutely, year on year, people are much more comfortable having conversations about their own vulnerability, being more open about the human effects of everything we do, whether it's sports, whether it's work, whether it's dealing with the global pandemic that we're still kind of experiencing in some ways. That openness has continued to advance. And I think part of that is that people everywhere are being touched by these issues, regardless of what their personal or professional histories might be. But what we're not talking enough about is the actual system that we provide. When someone builds the courage to ask for help, what do they get in return? And, you know, I've practiced and worked in multiple countries. In addition to my medical training, I have a PhD in education. And people keep looking to one place or the other, thinking, oh, maybe they have it better or they have it better. I don't think anybody's got it figured out. What we've got is an immense amount of hurt and suffering. And we have the same folks like yourself, myself, many of the people I work with that have been doing this year after year, being asked to do more and more and more with less. And that's just not going to work. It hasn't worked yesterday. It's not working today, and it's not going to work tomorrow.
You know, it seems like, especially for anybody involved in the research side or the science side of mental health, you know, there are advancements and there's understandings that are 10, 20 years ahead, maybe even further, of where we are in clinical practice. It's like Dr. Tom Insel has said this before, too, that we actually have effective interventions and solutions to a number of the struggles that we're dealing with, that the stuff isn't new. But there are systemic failures, I think, to try to implement those kinds of changes. So how do we actually overcome that hurdle?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that we're going to talk about on this podcast that help us understand that. One really important thing that we'll talk to Ken Duckworth about is the idea of co-design, co-production, really working with people who have lived experience, a living experience, and their caregivers to co-design services and step outside of existing hierarchical paradigms to question what expertise can and should mean. I think that's one. I think another really important piece is for those of us who work in the system to question long-held assumptions about vulnerability and self-disclosure. I think we tend in healthcare to dehumanize how we need to be cogs and machines, but we all know that that's not working, and that one moment of connection can build trust and help heal a lifetime of mistrust. So I think those are two key pieces. But the other really important thing, and I'm going to say this very candidly, is we are too fractured and fragmented. We have so many disciplines, so many fields, and I don't think we do a good enough job of working well together. We all share the same mission, and we all should share the same accountability for improvement. So I think that we need to end some of the territorialism, the siloing, the competition for scarce resources by really looking at what we can accomplish as a community of practice.
Yeah, it seems like the polarization, politicization, hyper-politicization that we've seen in society writ large has certainly impacted our helping professions as well. So I don't want to leave Dr. Duckworth waiting. You and I should get over and chat a bit with him. But we're going to have you back on the show lots to talk more about some of our other guests in the 10 episodes to come. Thank you so much again. Dr. Javeed Sukera is the chair of psychiatry at the Institute for Living at the Hartford Hospital. And he and I are going to go over and chat now with Dr. Ken Duckworth from NAMI. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Duckworth.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
So I have devoured your new book. I really enjoyed it. And I'm hoping that, you know, since this is an episode, our very first episode of this podcast, and we're talking all about consumer involvement, nothing about us without us, co-design in the mental health care space, I thought there'd be no better organization than NAMI for that. So why don't you tell us and our audience a little bit more about what NAMI actually is and how you help?
Mark, the National Alliance on Mental Illness is the largest grassroots organization, both of people who love, people who live with a mental illness, as well as people who have a lived experience. And so NAMI can be found in 49 states about 700 affiliates. If you're looking for a support group or an educational program, or you want to advocate for better services, your local or state NAMI is a great resource for you.
Dr. Sequeira, I mean, you and I have talked a number of times about the importance of consumer survivor and involvement. So I'm wondering if maybe you and Ken could have a bit of a discussion about how your two missions interact and how you work together to help people with mental illnesses.
Yeah, so maybe I can start and really invite further discussion. I would say that for those of us who are working within organizations, within existing systems, we rely heavily on organizations like NAMI who have been around, who help provide and create and support a community of practice, and who can help kind of keep the heat on many of us in our healthcare organizations. I think that's a really important thing that sometimes people are afraid of, a healthy tension. But to me, that healthy tension is an essential element that needs to be leveraged for growth. We know the status quo is unacceptable. We know that you can't fix tomorrow's problems with yesterday's solutions. And it makes the most sense for us to co-design what we need to do into the future with people who are served by the system. And I think that's also important to note, includes both people who are consumers and their caregivers, who often feel neglected, stigmatized, and left out of care.
Javed, I could not believe that no one had written this exact book, where you ask real people who use their names what helped them and what helped their families. My family could have used this book. My father had very bad bipolar disorder and was a very loving person. And I was so impressed going to my local bookstore that there was no book that actually asked real people, that all the books, in fact, are the same. My patients are my greatest teacher, but they're all not going to resemble anyone in the real world, any resemblance to any person, real or fictitious, et cetera, et cetera. These people aren't my patients. This is a community of people that wants to share their story. So the beauty of bringing the first person and family voice to the book is an example of what NAMI is trying to do. I also felt, you know, that it was remarkable that NAMI at 43 years old, now full-born middle age, did still not have a book. So I worked this problem internally at NAMI for a number of years, and then I was delighted to see how well it's all gone.
Well, there's a question I have for you, Ken, and that's a little bit about dichotomization, right? I think a lot of times when we've engaged, or organizations seek to engage, or professionals seek to engage, just like you alluded to with the lack of books out there, it's like, these are my patients and I am a professional. And I think what I found with some of my research is that's problematic, because that actually dehumanizes the professionals, right? To the degree that, you know, professionals suppress their emotions, think of themselves as somehow separate, that their vulnerability is somehow a weakness. How have you found that dichotomization through your journey and through the book?
Yeah, Javed, it's such a good question. I wrote a very both-and book. So several people advised me to write one book for family members / caretakers and one for people with lived experience / peers. And I actually wanted to do both end because I feel like we're all learning from each other. But I also want to include traditional experts in this book, because the idea that if you've lived with something or you've had something in your family that you also have expertise, I wanted our traditional experts like Andy Nierenberg from Mass General Hospital, who knows more about bipolar disorder than I'll ever learn in my career, or Judith Beck, whose father invented cognitive behavior therapy. I wanted the idea to place everyone on the same stage, that if you've lived with something, you're a kind of expert. If you've loved someone, you're a kind of expert. And if you've conducted 350 randomized controlled trials, you're a different kind of expert. And the idea would be, could we bring this book together with these three different perspectives on expertise? And that was really the joy of the book. And I completely agree with you. You know, the limitations that professionals can place on themselves through all the HIPAA rules, you know, and privacy importance. I do think there's a role for privacy, but one of the America's publishers that bid on the book told me that I couldn't get 50 people to use their real names. I stopped at 130 people simply because I ran out of time. I was trying to meet a deadline. I think I could have had 5,000 people tell their stories. As I've gone on the book tour across America, people said, oh, I want to be in your next book. There's nobody just like me in your book. I want to tell my story in your next book. So I've collected dozens and dozens of names. It's not clear to me at all if there'll be another book of this type or whether there'll be an updated version. But what I was impressed by is the one thing I may have gotten right is I may have perceived a change in our society going from isolation and privacy as the only choice to sharing your story to help others and make meaning of your experience as another choice. Again, that's a both and way of thinking. Some people still will prefer privacy. And this is not an ad to go tell your employer you're living with a major mental health condition. Another truth is there's 130 people who are happy to use their names and say where they're from. And I reviewed every single quote with every single person because I said, once there's 100,000 of these out, I can't take them back. And they all said, Ken, if it happened to me, it'll help someone else. This was the universal response. So I think we've also undervalued altruism in our field.
Yeah, it's almost like the people who work in healthcare have lost their voice along the way. And so we know that there are stories there that they want to tell, that they want to be able to tell. And I think that's where the idea of co-design goes hand in hand with bringing vulnerability and humanness into recovery.
Yeah, one of the things the publishers were interested in is I share my own experience. And, you know, I technically on paper am a child psychiatrist like you. But the truth is, you know, I went through a lot with my own dad and my own personal experience of grief and depression after my brother died. And, you know, it's just interesting. The publishers were very clearly interested in this idea. This was not a memoir, but I, the author, am also part of this entire community. That I'm neither above it or below it. We're all part of it. Mental health is health, and it's really common.
Yeah, it's that idea that there is no them. There's only us.
Exactly. Exactly. Maybe in college football, there's an us and a them, right? But I think in mental health, there isn't a need for that, right? And I think we've gotten very divided in the community. And I really wanted to write an integrative both end book. That was very intentional because people said, oh, you should write different books or different problems. No. The families learn from the individuals. The individuals are learning from the families. The experts are learning from both. And both of them can learn from the traditional experts.
Dr. Duckworth and Dr. Sakara, if you don't mind if I jump in for a second here, because I posted, Ken, a quote from your book to LinkedIn several weeks ago about this idea not only of lived experience, but of lived expertise and how important that is. Most people were inspired by that and liked that idea. But interestingly, there were some mental health professionals who commented from a place that I almost felt insecure. They commented something to the effect that lived expertise is, you got to remember that you're not an expert in anybody else's experience. True, of course. And that what you believe might not necessarily be what's the most helpful thing for you. So have you encountered in all of these 130 plus interviews, any kind of pushback from mental health professionals who might say, I'm the doctor, I'm the professional, I know best, and you need to learn from me? Have you ever gotten that kind of pushback?
Yeah, that population exists. I think it's getting smaller. I got kind of anxious once I got to the finishing part of the book. I contacted my chair at Harvard, and I said, Kesh, I want you to know Dr. Keshavan is a wonderful man. He's my academic chair. I said, I want you to know this book is kind of countercultural. This does not devalue professionals, but it elevates the voice of people who've been there. And I had this anxiety moment thinking, you know, I'd managed to, you know, violate unwritten rules in the field where you're not supposed to let people speak for themselves. What he said to me was, Ken, we're a field that needs to make this change. And I realized that I had stumbled upon this academic visionary who felt that there was more kind of expertise. So I'd say 9 out of 10 responses is, wait a minute, my experience could help someone else. You think that I learned something? after I dropped out of college and went to the YMCA and swam a mile a day to begin the process of moving ahead in my life? You think that could help someone else? And I'm like, Trevor, that definitely could help someone else because people don't have models like that. But it doesn't mean that each individual's experience is the right one for you. But there are 130 people who say, this is what worked in our family. This is what worked in my life. And I felt like that was kind of knowledge we had left on the sidelines. It doesn't also devalue the power of traditional expertise, right? So your experience with ECT is a different takeaway than Holly Lisenby, the director of the NIMH Division on Neurostimulation. They're both in the book. Holly Lisenby knows all the literature and all the research and is conducting millions of dollars in understanding. And some people felt that ECT saved their lives, and some of them had cognitive problems from it and developed their own kind of remediation plan about how they dealt with cognitive side effects. That's just one example. So again, it's not either or, it's very both and.
Dr. Sakara, how do you respond to that?
So I think to add to that, what I would say is part of the problem is that much of what we do in healthcare is very much in a zero-sum frame. So someone might enter a helping profession or wanting to be a mental health professional intrinsically being able to share the human aspects of that interaction. But there's a lot that we do through our training paradigms, through our clinical learning environments, that actually reinforces this idea that expertise is zero sum, and that somehow honoring and elevating, you know, the lived experience as expertise somehow diminishes. And so that's where we do a lot of, and we need to do a lot of unlearning, right? This is something that's meant to be shared. It doesn't devalue or diminish. It actually enriches and enhances. And I think when you take a health professional, like I said, who kind of lost their voice, and you say, no, you need to honor that voice. You need to find ways to decenter yourself, because this isn't about you, but also not dehumanize yourself. That's something people welcome. They're just not used to being able to do it.
And it's not a zero-sum game. You can learn from someone who found, you know, cognitive behavior therapy for psychosis made a difference for them and still not choose to use it. You just know that it's out there. It might be helpful to you in 5 years. So this has been the joy of the whole process. People were surprised by the idea. Wait, you want to talk to me? And I said, well, you have to use your name. And a few people said, wait a minute, I'm not ready to use my name. And I said, good. That is so important to know, because not every employer, not every social group is ready for this. But then it turns out there's all these people who said, I want my experience, whether it's child abuse, losing your kids to social services, being homeless, incarcerated. I mean, I met people through this process who had been through things that have very low social status. They all wanted to tell their story because they know there's millions of people just like them, who got addicted to OxyContin, or who had difficulty finding the right diagnosis or pathway or way to communicate in their family. So that's why this project was like the joy of my career, because it's the one idea I really felt was missing from our literature, is let's listen to the actual people who are experiencing things.
I think that's a great place to leave it right there. That's a perfect natural cut point for us. So Dr. Duckworth, did you have anything else? Or actually first, Dr. Sakara, did you have anything else that you wanted to ask Ken that we could fit in here?
I have a thousand things I'd love to ask. Maybe I'll go back to this issue of self-disclosure. And, you know, for you in your journey, as you got to that point where you knew that part of honoring these stories was actually honoring your own, what helped you unlearn and kind of liberate yourself from some of those things that might have been internalized over time?
I think I was born in the wrong decade, because, you know, I did this in 1986 when I was applying to my psychiatric resident, And my, why do I want to become a psychiatrist? My dad's loving, fun, charismatic, brilliant, and periodically living in a state hospital. So I want to understand what was that phenomenon that no one could talk about. And I had violated yet another unwritten rule, which was you weren't allowed to talk about anything that involved yourself or your family. And of course, this is a long time ago. And only one person across the country encouraged me and said that this was an additional experience. What's interesting to me is that when I talk to people in medical schools, they still struggle with the same question. Is it safe to discuss the fact that I have an eating disorder in my residency for internal medicine? Is my lived experience of having a serious depression that caused me to be suicidal at Duke, should I involve that in my residency application? Because I know what it's like. And so, of course, what I shared with them is you have to make your own decisions. But remember, not everybody is ready for this kind of self-disclosure. I think, you know, I encourage people get into the residency and then assess the culture and share your experience as you see fit. So I never struggled with this question. This is just my, you know, personal experience. But the field was extremely unwelcoming to me back in 1986. And I was impressed that many people still wonder whether they should disclose or not today. And I don't have an answer for that question. All I say is there's a lot of people that are willing to disclose. I just can't assess what the culture of your institution, what their response would be. There was just a piece in the New York Times called I withheld my mental illness history from my college application. I am not alone. Right? Again, this is a dilemma that people are facing these days. But the fact that you can even have this discussion, you couldn't have this discussion when I was applying to be a resident. I think my essay stood out like a sore thumb, not in a good way, across America's best residencies. People ignored it. One person told me it was a terrible reason to become a psychiatrist. This was at a world famous institution. And I asked that world famous person, again, I'm 26, I know no one, I have no connections. I'm thinking I'm going to end up in cardiology because this is not going well. And I asked him what was a good reason. He paused for a moment, he looked back and he said, well, maybe if your father was a psychiatrist. This is not a person really thinking about the workforce shortage that we face, right? This is not a way to approach bringing more voices into our work. So I always share that story because it's a true story. The field needs to be able to embrace people with lived experience, both from their own life and their families, and provide supports because we have a profound shortage of people in the mental health workforce. And I believe that there's a place for people who have a history of mental health conditions to help other people. And I think some of them will be some of the best people we have. So that's my take on it. I do think it's an evolving world that we live in. I don't think this book was possible 10 years ago, and I don't think a bunch of publishers would have bid on it. Something has changed in our society, and I can't tell you whether that's Simone Biles or NAMI or Prince Harry. I can't tell you where it starts and begins, but something has changed around self-disclosure, so it's a very interesting time to be part of this adventure. I want to thank you for having me, by the way. And all the royalties from the sale of this book go to NAMI. NAMI has the copyright. This is basically a love gift to an organization that I've observed doing a lot of beautiful work over time. All the classes, all the support groups are free all across America.
And the book is You Are Not Alone. I have it right here, holding it up for the camera. The NAMI Guide to Navigating Mental Health. You can get that. Where can you get it, Ken?
Yeah, anywhere books are sold. It's in your local bookstore. It's on Amazon. Amazon figured out how to sell it for under $18, which is, I guess, how they've gotten so wealthy because they realized the book was selling, so they lowered the price of the book. It's on audiobooks. It's going to be translated into Chinese. There's a UK version. So all I could say is if you're interested in this question, the learning from real people, and the real people will talk to you. Like if you want to learn from that guy who dropped out of college and figured that swimming and motion was his best path forward, send me an email. I'll connect you to Trevor. He's a lovely man. And he was so proud. When I go across the country, the people in the book are on the stage with me at the book events. They talk about what they've learned and why they wanted to be in the book. It's been quite beautiful. And they all want to help other people. They all want to make meaning of the experience.
Thank you to Dr. Ken Duckworth and Dr. Javed Sukhera for kicking off Modern Minds for us today. Next up, I talk with Emmy Nietfeld about her article in the New York Times, her memoir Acceptance, and the idea of disclosure and lived expertise. All that and much more in just about 30 seconds. We'll be right back.
Mental health is health. At the Institute of Living, we are pioneers in mental health. And we have been for 200 years. We have an ambition to transform mental health services while co-designing these services with those whom we serve. Together, we can reduce stigma, address discrimination, and increase access to care.
Welcome back to the Modern Minds podcast. I'm Mark Hennick. My next guest is Emmy Nietfeld. Emmy is the author of Acceptance, a memoir of her journey through foster care and homelessness, interrogating the true meanings of resilience, ambition, and success. She's also an accomplished essayist, having been featured by such outlets as The Atlantic, Teen Vogue, and Fortune. You also just heard Dr. Ken Duckworth make reference to her recent piece in the New York Times, which we discussed in depth. So here's my conversation with Emmy Nietfeld. Emmy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
So now you're the author of Acceptance, a memoir. You share your personal story so incredibly eloquently and bravely. I want to come back to that in a minute, because the reason why I wanted to talk to you, first of all, with the topic of our episode today being co-design in mental health, inclusion in mental health, was because you wrote an article for the New York Times called "I Edited Mental Illness Out of My College Applications. I'm Not Alone." For those who are listening, and we're going to share it in the social media when we share this episode, but for those who haven't read it yet, can you tell me what that article was about and what inspired you to write it?
Yes. So that article is about how students facing a worsening teen mental health crisis are choosing to disclose or explain or not explain mental health conditions when they're applying to college. And this was inspired by my own journey, where in high school, I was in foster care for a while, I was homeless for a while, and I was also involved in the therapy and psychiatry systems, which ended up having a big impact on my transcript and where I went to school and what grades I had from what places. And it was really hard to hide.
Mm. When you were in school, I assume, if your experience is anything like mine was, because, you know, my the worst part of my mental illness was right when I was in middle school and high school. And I think my schooling, my performance at school was the place that was affected the most, or at least that's where it was the most obvious. So can you tell us a little bit maybe more about your own backstory, your own story there, how your symptoms manifested and how it impacted you at school?
Yeah, I had a very tumultuous home life when starting around my parents' divorce when I was 10 years old. And my mom struggled with compulsive shopping and hoarding. But part of the problem is that she couldn't see that there was a problem. And so instead, I was taken to the doctor, I was medicated, and I did become very depressed. I suffered from an eating disorder and self-harm. And for me, my education was impacted by different placements. I was hospitalized repeatedly, and I spent 9 months in a locked residential treatment center before I went into foster care. And so when I was sitting down trying to explain to colleges, it really didn't feel like an option to just not explain why I had so many schools on my transcript.
Yeah. You know, we spend so much time now that mental health conversations are so popular, and, you know, that's a crass way of putting it, but they are popular now. I remember when I was in high school, we didn't talk about things on, especially not in popular media, about mental health. But one of the main messages that comes up all the time, it's very inspiring, and it's not wrong, I don't think, is to encourage people to reach out for help. I still think that is a good message. There's a risk there, right? You know, that what if we're encouraging people to reach out and the people that they reach out to aren't the people who can best help them. It might even be a potentially traumatic experience. So what's your feeling of how we're doing mental health advocacy now in terms of the messaging with respect to how mixed up and broken the system actually is?
That's such a great question. And I think it really hits at a missing link in the discourse around mental health, where we do have these formulaic answers of like, go seek therapy and go talk to someone, maybe take medication, when we know the reality is sometimes the help you get is going to be great and other times it's going to be more harmful. And so I think it's really important for families and patients to have a sense of what is available, of what different kinds of treatment there are, of what is known to work pretty well, and of how important the therapeutic relationship is. It's really almost impossible to expect someone to get better in an environment where they feel like they're being re-traumatized.
Well, that's just it. You know, we're talking in this whole episode about inclusion, about co-design in mental health, but really, I think that presupposes that people have disclosed, right? In order to include people with lived experience, you can't do that to them. I hope not anyway, that they have to be invited to the table in a meaningful way. So maybe you can frame this for me around your own experience of disclosure, of opening up. I don't know, maybe you were always open about your struggles, maybe not, but what was it like before that? And what was it like after you actually did start to open up about your own story?
I wrote about this in the New York Times article where initially when I was applying to college, I was very open. And the people who were helping me put together my application, they thought, if you talk about your depression, your PTSD, that will help colleges understand the significance of what you've been through. And then the reality was, it didn't exactly work like that. Instead, my disclosure seemed to raise a lot of red flags. I was rejected early from Yale. And when I applied in the regular decision round, I omitted everything and I got into Harvard. And that type of consequence for disclosure is very, very common. And so there's real concrete reasons why people don't want to disclose. And after having an experience like that, for me, it took years to be comfortable enough to disclose enough to get a therapist, and especially a therapist who was going to be able to specialize in PTSD, which is what I was seeking help for.
And what do you think that experience taught you about the art of disclosure? What that even is? How do you do it better now?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think there's so many unwritten rules about what is okay to talk about and what's not. Even in our current discourse around mental health, talking to even students who are 18 and 19 years old, everyone was telling me, they were saying, you know, it's okay to have depression. It's okay to have some anxiety. But basically anything beyond that was still really considered taboo to talk about. And I think that's a place where as a society, we can go a long way. And I think more practically, you know, there's different levels of detail for different people and for the different situation that you might be in.
That's such a good point. You know, I've one of my concerns with the mental health awareness, the great mental health awareness that's been happening, is that it still seems so surface level, right? That all mental illnesses are the same, that all severities are the same, all struggles are the same, and they're really not. That just like in physical illnesses, there's a vast diversity. So now, how do you think that's something that we've learned from people with lived experience talking about their experiences, right? That if you show me 10 different people with depression, you're going to show me 10 different ways to be depressed. That's just the way these things work. So how do you think then our healthcare system and individual healthcare providers as well can kind of get their arms around that? How do you think that they can do a better job of helping, of doing recovery with people instead of doing recovery to people or at people? How do you actually include such diversity in that process?
That's such a great question. In my experience, when I was looking for help, I would go to a provider and I would really be offered one choice. And it happened to be whatever choice that provider specialized in. And once I started doing my own research, I found that there were actually multiple different paths that could work really well for the problems that I was facing. And I think it would have been super helpful to me at the very beginning to be given those options and told, okay, you know, exposure therapy works well for a lot of people. Some people don't want to do that. Medication can also work well. And just really had my options laid out before me. And luckily, I was in a position where I really could make those informed choices. You know, sometimes people are going through such a hard time that it's hard to even make those. But I think almost no matter what situation somebody's in, even a little bit of choice can go a long way in kind of restoring the agency that mental illness can take away.
Now, I mean, we've been talking about the benefits of inclusion and co-designing treatment for the individual person who's struggling, but above and beyond that individual person being included in their own treatment, what do you think are the benefits of including people with lived experience or people with lived expertise? I'm interested in hearing your reaction to that term. What do you think the benefit is to including us as a group for others over and above us, so it's not so individual?
I love that expression, lived expertise. And I think that people are waking up to the fact that if there's a whole community of people who have been navigating mental illness for years or decades, there's a lot of things that they've learned along the way. And it would be really wise to pay attention to that. I think that there are pretty common responses to how people react to certain treatments, right? Like, it's a very common thing where someone goes to the doctor and they're told, you know, this is a psychosomatic issue. And the feelings that result from that kind of pseudo-diagnosis are pretty common, of like feeling invalidated or not heard, you know, even if there is a psychological component to what's going on. And so I think that methods of just, you know, from the initial intake session to treatment, like really having that radical empathy that someone with lived expertise can contribute is really important to helping people seek help and then stay the course to receive help.
What do you think are the, let me say it this way. I think there's both benefits and risks, and the benefits outweigh the risks of having public mental health advocates out there. I mean, I do it myself. You're doing it now as well. But having people like us out there sharing their stories inspires hope, and it encourages other people to do the same. And I think that's a good thing. I think there's also potentially a risk, though, in communicating a message that if I did it, you can too, or if I did it, why can't you? So then how do we get away from one person's individual experience, sort of simplistically overgeneralizing it and saying, you know, therefore the treatment that worked for me will work for everybody?
I think a huge part of that is having mental health advocates whose message is not, hey, I overcame and I'm completely better now. This is something that I think about a lot, because when I wrote my book, Acceptance, I was still dealing with quite a few symptoms of PTSD. You know, I still have them and I probably will my whole life. And as a culture, we're obsessed with these stories of triumph and with people being all the way better, when in a lot of cases, that's just simply not realistic. And I think that there's a real opportunity for the idea of advocacy to advance through mental health, so that you can have people who are not saying, hey, if I did it, I can too, but like, this is what success can look like. And it can look like sometimes needing to receive care over a really long period of time and never really being cured.
Opening up about your own experience with a mental illness, I don't know if you found this too, but there's a certain weight to that, right? I mean, there's the initial diagnosis that comes, and I felt a certain relief with that, right? I have something that I can call this thing. But then opening up about it, especially publicly, it's like you're taking on that mantle, you're taking on that label, and there can feel like, I think, a certain permanence to that. So do you think that there's anything that people who want to either get involved in their own treatment or become more publicly involved as a mental health advocate for people with lived experience, Is there anything that you think that they want to, they should probably keep in mind in order to protect themselves, either from overextending themselves or re-traumatizing themselves or you know, harming themselves in some way?
That's such a good question. And I dealt with this for years when I was very, very private about my background and my history and my diagnoses. And I think the most important message that I have for people is that you should not feel pressure to disclose or to be a public face for a disorder. You know, there, we often have that expectation that like good patients are willing to be completely forthright, when I think the most important thing is taking care of your own health. And for me, I reached a point where it became better for my own health, really, to start opening up in small ways to people I could really trust. And so I started with family members and friends. And those were actually some of the hardest conversations, because it meant going back over shared experiences and filling them in on what those things were often like for me and what was going on internally. And I think whatever level of disclosure someone decides to do, that is wonderful and great, and that it's also okay to keep stuff between you and your doctor and your therapist or your journal or your favorite stuffed animal.
Yeah, I think this relates to a couple of the things that you said today, but do you think that there's a, I know your answer already, but I don't know why I'm asking, but I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on it. What do you think then, I'll frame it this way, what do you think then about the idea of the model patient or the model mentally ill person who, you know, like you say, has triumphed and had a beautiful struggle, and now, what's your reaction to that, idea?
It can be a good story. It's certainly an easy story to tell because we're all used to it. I also think it can be really, really damaging. And for people who that story is their life, more power to them. I'm glad that they have come to that place. And I think it's equally as important for people who are not the model patient to kind of shatter some of those stereotypes about who is worthy of help and care and of raising awareness.
Yeah, it's almost like it's a good story, but it's a fictional story, because I don't think I've met anybody yet who is actually really good at recovery and who, you know, who fits that narrative. But, you know, I think that's almost, it reminds me too of how, you know, we encourage people to open up about their experience, and then they open up and it's kind of, not like that, or don't do that. So I think we have to be able to embrace the messiness that is this process.
Absolutely.
Well, Emmy, thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight. Your book, Acceptance, A Memoir, is available everywhere now. The article in the New York Times, which we're going to share with this, I edited mental illness out of my college applications. I'm not alone. Thank you so much for writing both.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
Many thanks to Emmy Nietfeld for talking with me today. Before we wrap up, I'm going to throw this over to our friend in the field, Brian Spiros from Hartford Healthcare. Brian's going to check in quickly with one more person that we think you should hear from on the theme of patient engagement in program design. Over to you, Brian.
Thank you, Mark. We are going to continue this conversation now centered around Nothing About Us Without Us, looking a little closer at the Hartford Healthcare perspective. And joining me now is Dr. Karen Kangas. She's the Director of Recovery and Family Affairs for the Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network and the former Director of Recovery and Community Education at the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, my background is I actually have a doctorate in education, and I've taught for many years. I ended my teaching career as a principal of a school, which I loved, and I ended up having some mental health challenges, and I ended up going into the hospital. And while I was there, the superintendent of schools came in and said, "And when you get out, we are going to fire you."
Wow.
And it was like, wow, I didn't do anything wrong, and why are you doing this to me? And it made me kind of think about what is my next career, because I'm not sure I was still certified to work in education and license and all that, but I thought, I want to do something different. So I ended up meeting a lot of people, and actually people said, why don't you start talking about your own mental health? Would you be willing to diagnose? Would you be willing to open up and disclose? And I thought, you know, I would. I would.
And that brings us up to a term, lived experience. Right. Tell us what lived experience is for anyone who may not know what it is.
Right. And we're using that term now because we'd rather not use all the labels that people have given us. And lived experience means you've had some mental health and or both addiction challenges. And you've really gone through them. You've had treatment. You've done the all kinds of pathways to recovery. And you feel really good about yourself right now. And you're willing to tell other people and to help other people.
Which is key in all of this. So there's something called the Hartford Healthcare Recovery Leadership Academy. Tell us about the program and what it's doing.
And the program is an 80-hour program that people will register to come. We have one starting very soon, and we have 102 people ready to come on, and they're going to be on Zoom. But I have recorded people from all over the country that have given me their perspective on how recovery is a part of it and how we really care about all of that. And so they're coming to learn how to be a recovery support specialist, all the kinds of skills that needs in terms of the boundaries and the ethics and all those kind of things. And what does it mean? And how do you help people? And how do you support people?
And these are people who went through their own issues, and now it's come full circle,
yeah,
and they're helping others.
And they want to help others. We just get so many applications, I cannot tell you. I accepted one last night, and I shouldn't have. So people are really excited about doing this.
All right. So, you know, with all of this, this lived experience, how does this benefit our patients?
It benefits our patients because we can say to them, look, I know you're struggling right now, and it's hard. I'm going to give you some hope because, you know something? I've been there, too. I've been in this hospital before. Oh, my gosh. And I wasn't happy either. But you know what? There's a whole way through all of this. And let me help you guide you. Let me give you some resources. Let me give you some hope because we really need to hang on to that. And I will be with you. I'll be with you in the hospital, and I will follow you out of the hospital.
And the patients must be very receptive, especially when they know someone's working with them who has been down this road.
We do one-on-ones, and we do groups together with people and try to increase their skills and their resources that they need to survive and to be active in their communities. That's the goal. Back in their communities healthy and well.
All right. And that's what we want, of course. So, you know, we've certainly come a long way with focusing on lived experience, but how can Hartford Healthcare and other healthcare organizations really continue to improve in this area? Because for some people, it's a new concept.
Okay, and this is not a new concept in terms of the White House is involved in it. We have Samhsa wants 100 million people hired in this category because we are the workforce of the future because we're there. We want to be there. We're not saying we want to stay home. We want to be there. We want to help. And so it's really gotten the attention of everybody across. In fact, President has now got a new person that's really looking at standards, so we are kind of standardizing across the country. And so we're able then, if Hartford Healthcare were to open up more positions, because that's what we really need. We have the people. They have to have the spots. And we have to think of creative ways of doing that because money is in a short supply. We understand that.
Right.
But we're really wanting to be there. So I want to extend the fact that we give that hope. And we are excited about our recovery. I'm excited to say I have mental health and I have addictions. And it's okay. I have a life. I love it.
And people should know they're not going through this stuff alone.
You're not going alone. That's the number one thing. You're not alone. You're not alone. I used to bring one person to it. Now I can, if you wanted me to bring this whole studio filled, I can bring that studio filled with people that are in recovery.
Absolutely. So a lot of good being done with this lived, you know, experience approach in all of this. And I thank you for all the information. It's eye-opening for a lot of people.
Thank you. I enjoy doing it because it's my thing. It's my passion.
Yes, I can tell it is. Dr. Karen Kangas, thank you so much. Mark, we'll send it back to you.
Thanks, Brian. And thank you all so much for joining us this month on the very first episode of the Modern Minds podcast. Next month, we're going to be talking about architecture and environmental design and supporting mental health and recovery. So make sure that you come back for that one. Every single episode is going to be available in both audio and video on Spotify. So follow the show over there to get notified as soon as the next new one is up. I'm also going to stream video from each episode on all of my social pages at Mark Hennick. That's at MarkHennick on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube, just about everywhere else. And also the audio only episodes of the audio only versions rather of every episode. Those are going to be up on all of the usual podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google, Amazon, Audible, iHeartRadio, and all the others. So I look forward to talking with you again next time. Until then, I've been Mark Hennick, and this has been Modern Minds.